All right, so welcome back, guys. And now we're on the future of the web panel. And this is going to be a very general and opinionated discussion on the future of front-end web frameworks, dev tools for building web apps, and basically anything to do with the web. And with us are some really, really awesome people. With us are Steve Fisher, who is a...
That's him.
He's a designer and UX fanatic at Republic of Quality in Vancouver. As well, we have Alex Blom. He's a Ember.js web developer and partner at Isle of Code here in Toronto. So he's a local guy. If you have any questions or maybe you'll see him at a meetup or something, definitely go say hi. We also have Wes Boss, who's come in from Hamilton. Wes is a full-stack web developer and web designer, and he's the creator of the extremely popular React for Beginners video series, as well as the Sublime Power Users textbook. And all the way from New York City, we've got Stacy Mulcahy. She's a JavaScript and Node extraordinaire, all right? And she works with us at Microsoft in New York City. My name is Rami Sayar. I'm a technical evangelist based out of Montreal, and I focus on web and open source, and we're really gonna dive into a very, hopefully, opinionated discussion. We've got a React guy, we've got an Ember guy, we've got someone who does Angular, someone who does UX, so I think it's gonna be really interesting. So speaking of all these frameworks, we've seen like the emergence of these big frameworks over the last couple of years. The popularity has increased. I think Angular 2 and React have like exploded, especially this year. And really, I sort of want to get your opinions on sort of the current state of the art for front-end web frameworks, and just state of the art as well for web trends. All right, so I don't know who wants to start us off.
I don't want to give a shot.
Sure. All right. So I dispute that Ember's also growing pretty quickly. just to throw that one out there. But what's interesting, at least from our perspective, so we focus on doing hybrid work with Ember, very explicitly building mobile applications with it. And what's been interesting is, as much as we've been saying for many, many years that we could potentially match native performance, it's really only been the last 12 to 18 months that that's actually been something that we can do in most scenarios. So for us, that's probably been the most interesting thing to be working on lately. And that's only getting better, so.
Awesome. And are you finding that trend as well with some of the other stuff that's
happening? Yeah, I think over the last couple of years, obviously JavaScript just keeps growing and growing year over year. And I think a lot of critical mass of developers are starting to look at these bigger frameworks rather than just using a jQuery or a regular vanilla JavaScript. They're looking at my app is a lot more involved, so what's the stack that I need in order to make that work?
So what are you guys developing with every day, just out of curiosity?
My stack right now is React on the front end. I use Node on the back end, specifically Express, Passport, Jade, Stylus, pretty much all that stuff. But I really always like to dip my toes into everything. I'm not specifically a React guy, and I don't necessarily like that when people call me a React guy, because I like to try everything and make sure that it's a good fit for a project.
I mean, I'm going to be the opposite. I'm Angular, but Angular is because that's what I started with. I did a little Backbone. I've done a little Ember. I think I'm enough where I can pick up most of the frameworks. But on a day-to-day, if I feel that I need a framework, which is another thing, like you don't always need frameworks, again.
Yeah, I like to use JavaScript.
Let's duke this out. But like, you know, sometimes it's overkill for what you're doing. So for me, I'm Angular. If I'm going to pick a framework or Backbone, I still like Backbone. I'm sorry, I'm not afraid to admit it.
Sweet. I guess on our side, obviously, we use Ember. We'll typically do a Rails backend if we can. Simply, if you're not familiar, there's this thing called Ember Data. It plugs really nicely into Rails. So it just handles how we're going to communicate with the server, how do we do fetches, how do we handle saves. It's nice just not worrying about that problem, which is really why you pick an Ember in the first place. Then another little shout out for going for Android, we'll typically use this thing called Crosswalk as well. And Crosswalk will make sure that it will render the same on every Android device, because obviously your in-app browser is a little bit different depending on the platform you're on. So both gives you better performance for older devices, but also makes sure that everything's actually passing the same on every device, which isn't always the case with Android.
I mostly use Sharpies and Post-it notes.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time working with various technology companies, and so while my job is involved in technology, it shifts all the time. So I see people using like a lot of different frameworks and not agreeing about it, but also not using them too.
Yeah.
And just saying, this is the way I want to do it, or this is what I feel the project needs.
Just jump in as well. That's usually a good approach, and to your comment as well, I find that when you don't use a framework, where that hurts you is when your app becomes a little bit bigger, especially in JS, because most JS people don't actually understand how JS works. So they start having just these, you know, huge memory leak problems or something like that, and their performance just degrades. Yeah. If you're having that, maybe that's a sign that you should actually just be adopting a framework, because it will handle a lot of those problems for you. Doesn't mean you shouldn't learn about them, but it will actually just make it not a problem.
Do you feel that maybe people should just spend some time learning JavaScript properly?
That's not going to happen, though.
It's not going to happen.
Too many code schools.
So what if we added something on top of it, like maybe CoffeeScript or TypeScript? Will that solve the problem?
Okay, so I have a bit of a hate on for CoffeeScript, to be perfectly honest.
Hence why I asked you.
Yeah. My opinion of stuff like that is that I don't want to maintain half the shit that I write, right? We deal with a lot of different clients, and I shouldn't say what I write is shit, but I don't want to have to deal with maintaining it. My problem with a lot of coffee things is that the average developer doesn't know that, but they can certainly understand JS syntax. So just in terms of a pass-off, I'd much prefer to write vanilla from that respect. Obviously, though, with ES, I still call it 6, not 2016. I don't know much of a reason to use coffee anymore.
Yeah, but with Angular 2, you're starting to see like TypeScript be the main way that you're building Angular 2 apps.
So Glimmer 2 in Ember also uses TypeScript.
Okay.
Very much for TypeScript.
Yeah, very much for TypeScript. Okay. Now, I know that you guys spend a lot of time doing these types of large, complex apps for your clients or just when you're building your products. But when it comes time to your play time, what are you playing with? What are you trying to learn right now? And maybe that will give us a hint of sort of the future of the web, basically. What are you most excited about today?
I know you play with a lot of cool stuff, so let's hear that.
I don't know if it's got a cute name, .javascript. I've tried it. I think that one of the most interesting things in the last year or 2 years has been the development of libraries for robotics, you know, JavaScript robotics. And we talk about JavaScript kind of like being everywhere and kind of, you know, not just in the browser. And you're starting to see across the board, for me, you know, Johnny Five, Cylon, any of those kind of things that are abstracting, like how you might work with a device like an Arduino or whatnot, like I'm all over that. So that's where I've been playing probably for the last year or so. And I think that the work and the communities and all the things that you can do around there is super interesting.
It's cool. For me, I've been researching lately a better way to talk to the server. So I think the whole REST endpoint, going back and forth and getting your JSON, I don't think it's easy for a lot of people to get up and running with, and B, I think it's a little bit limiting, and sometimes when you have like complex UIs, you need to make a lot of requests. So I don't know what it is. I've been looking at things like GraphQL, which is coming out from Facebook, or things like Firebase, where you can have WebSockets and go immediately back and forth between the two. So I don't know what it is that's going to sort of come ahead in that pack, but I think that is that's what I'm spending my time with lately.
Interesting.
Yeah, so on my side, and again, it's very much about the hybrid stuff, but there are two things that I'm playing around with a lot. One is just actually watching how is memory happening, specifically in Ember, but also what's going on inside of these browsers. Because what you start to discover is there are a lot of common problems that maybe people aren't aware of, that they're tripping up all the time. Maybe a quick example of that is, you know, one of the big things we see all the time is people who don't resolve promises. And that's just going to sit in memory forever, and you're just going to start bloating and bloating and bloating the more that you go. The research area that we find interesting at the moment is how can we start maybe introducing not actual threads in this environment, but we have web workers. So what is the overhead trade-off if we want to, say, make our AJAX request and push JSON, you know, as a string or as a JSON object back to our main thread? And, you know, in a single request, that's not very efficient, but where does that inflection point happen? We can start to maybe introduce some parallelism here. So that's kind of my interest area right now.
Yeah. And for me, it's, again, sort of less technical and more understanding how teams work together and how that's changing over time, like how someone like me who is a user experience designer, user experience architect, maybe in the past could avoid knowing certain things, but now really has to have that as part of their workflow, understanding that.
So yeah, a question about that, how is it impacting your day-to-day when you're working with the UX and trying to come up with designs, all of these new technologies that are changing how apps are actually being coded? Are you seeing an impact when it comes to UX?
Well, sure. I think this is—it's always been there, but it has more impact now, just because we're forced to do it. With thinking about expectations of things will work across all devices, interdisciplinary teams are becoming more and more important for us to understand what it is that someone else does and why they're doing it,
not necessarily to be able to do all those things ourselves, has become critical to what I do, but what everyone on the team does. As much as I need to understand what you're doing, you need to understand what I'm doing and why I'm talking to people and doing some of the research and planning that way too. It's been fabulous. I feel like if we're thinking about the future of the web here and where it's at right now, it's sort of like we've gotten to this point of finally maturing a bit, you know, past that 20 years to the point where we're saying, oh, this is what our medium is. Mm. We're starting to understand it in a way that was different than before, although of course it's ever changing.
Yeah, and do you guys feel that the same when it comes to this pace of change? Are we getting actually to a state where things are a little bit more mature? Whether it's the framework, how we design our web apps, how we...
I don't know that mature is the word that I'd use. I think you have states where things move very quickly and states where we maybe stabilize and everybody's coming to the same ideas. But that's just a sign that once we all stabilize on certain ideas, somebody's going to have a way better one again.
Okay.
I think maybe that the rate of change is more focused on internals and externals right now.
Okay.
You know, again, I keep bringing it back to Ember, but that's just because that's what I work in most of the day. Most of the rapid changes in that lately have been about making Ember internally faster, not introducing new features to Ember. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe you don't notice as much change, but if you're working in it every day, it's still certainly changing very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not really a sense of change. It's a sense of understanding what our medium is. I think there was a lot of misunderstanding in the early years because there's just so much fundamental experimentation of something that was really brand new as a profession even. Not that people weren't doing computer science and doing programming and this for years, but I don't know, from my perspective in the last 5-6 years, there's something that's a little bit different in our industry. But yeah, rapid change all the time, but the way our industry functions feels different to me right now with the web.
I'd certainly agree with that to the extent that it's less Wild West, maybe is the right way to put it. Like, we do have like standard tools to maybe approach problems, whereas before your first challenge was to build a tool to approach the problem.
Yeah, so even what is this thing called?
You know, we still argue about that between like Angular, Ember, and React have the same thing with completely different words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, it is, we're all writing JavaScript now, which is step one.
Yeah,
step one, for sure. And speaking of all these tools, we've seen a lot of these tools become extremely popular and sort of a required dependency for any type of web project and sometimes even non-web projects. I mean, if you think of Grunt, Gulp, NPM, it seems like as if even if I'm just a web designer, I need to have those installed. Even if I'm not writing a single line of JavaScript or a single line of HTML5, I need them. So then the question is, well, if you have all these tools and sort of these dev tools that are being created, how do you still manage to build your team? Right? Like, how do you actually do that? And to take advantage of all of these tools that are pretty much everywhere, how do you sort of bring the back end and the front end teams together? How do you bring the designers? How do you bring the UX, the content writers? How do you sort of build this process and tools?
Well, from my perspective, which is going to be very different than the rest here, I think, it's that the idea of us coming together throughout, that sure, there are different phases within any type of project, whether you're building an app, a website, whatever it happens to be, but us understanding what's happening at each stage, like being there together and not waiting at some point to bring in a designer or to bring in a developer or to bring in this specialist here and there, to see that we spend more time connecting. And that doesn't mean that we're always in the same room all the time doing the things together, but less silos is really been the key, or busting through those ones, more communication. Because there seem to have been a lot of silos over time where like there's animosity between different disciplines where there really shouldn't be.
Yeah.
There's no reason for it.
And do you feel with the common tools like maybe GitHub, like GitHub is being used for everything these days?
Well, yeah, GitHub's a great example. So someone who doesn't code at all is still contributing to GitHub, right? Versus someone that is contributing significant amounts of code to it. It is a tool that we can share and use commonly. So, and pretty easy to access.
Yeah.
I think also, like, in terms of just if we're talking about the team development and how you might start a web project, especially for a client, versus how you, you know, today as you would have 5 or 6 years ago, is that there's that sense of we're actually got different processes and deliverables to the client, right? And so we start talking about things like Brad Frost's, you know, atomic design. We start thinking about things whether or not in modules or pieces or, you know, for some things and moving away for that for others. And so there's a definite change in how you think about it, how you approach it, how you design for it. You know, people are saying spend less time in Photoshop, spend more time in the browser. That's a whole nother argument, right? But you're starting to see all of these things just kind of move. And along with it, how do you explain to a client that I can't show you what it's going to look like on every device? Like, really? You want me to do that? You know how much work that is? Whereas, you know, a functioning prototype very quickly get up and running. And so it's, I think a little bit it's also from the design and team perspective is that we've had to kind of push away from our comfort zone in terms of what we use. Like to tell a designer they can't use Photoshop freaks them out, right? And as it should, that's how they sketch their ideas. We sketch our ideas through code.
Well, and that's so true. Like you have to move away from the lies of a static comp or a Photoshop file because there's no way to represent a fluid medium like the web in a static comp. Right? Until it's in its medium, we can't know the problems, where it's going to break, where it's going to succeed. And I think maybe, you know, maybe this is, from a designer's perspective, me understanding my own statement from earlier of maturity in that, you know, a developer would have operated under, well, we're going to build this thing and try it and build it and try it, right? Whereas a designer is like, I shouldn't blanket statement here, but sometimes like, hey, I designed that. It's done. Don't you understand? You know, I know I've had those feelings at times, but that's definitely not true about the web. It just isn't. It's living.
Yeah.
So
maybe to build on that as well, just as an interesting aside, we won't work with designers that won't write their own CSS.
Okay.
We just have a requirement that if you're going to build a thing for this platform, you should actually be able to build a thing for this platform. And, you know, if other people maybe can work with just PSDs, but we consider that the cutoff. And a lot of problems went away after that. You know, even just, you know, you get these weird things that, you know, have a circle and a triangle coming out, and you're like, I can't do that. And all of a sudden, that's not a problem anymore because they're forced to face the problems we were facing. All of a sudden, that goes away. And just to answer the earlier question as well in terms of, you know, how do we deal with all this grunt and gulp? My view of the world is that we're building an Ember app. Yeah. So maybe you don't need to be able to write advanced Ember, but if you're working on our team, you should certainly be able to go and run Ember server and do the basics. If that means we need to spend a week or two teaching you, then so be it. But that's the thing we're producing, and we should all know how to do it.
So there's a bit of a sort of unification in all the tools and processes and how the teams operate, no matter if you're a content designer, a UX person, a front-end developer. Like, do you find that, has that worked for you guys?
So we're a relatively small team, right? We're in three cities, but we have small teams in each city.
Yeah.
So that's less of a problem, but I should also clarify, everybody in our company is a programmer, and we're kind of serious about that. But we just consider that the minimum level of literacy to be working on what we're doing now.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the minimum level of literacy maybe has gone up even though the web has gotten easier. Mm-hmm. Because there are more complex things going on now, especially if you're doing front-end based dev.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'd add to that is just be willing to be wrong about decisions that you've made. Because you make all these decisions about what tools you're using and then you get so stuck on them and people dig their heels in. But at the end of the day, it's just whatever we need to do to get the job done and just be open to accepting that you're wrong and bringing on a new tool or a new method of doing things with other people, right?
Yeah.
At what point, like this is a question I guess to everyone.
Yeah.
At what point when, let's say you're working and you see on Twitter people are talking about the new thing, whatever the new thing may be, at what point do you say, I'm going to try that, I should try that because of X, Y, whatever?
Yeah. If it brings you actual value, if it's going to make your application better, if it's going to make your application faster, like if you're actually getting something of value out of it, then absolutely you should look into maybe I should be adopting this. But if it's just because it's the hot tool of the day or it's because everyone's tweeting about it, that's not reason enough to stop your actual work because that gets in the way of your deliverables.
Yeah, I think for me, like if it, and it kind of comes back to designers being able to code to a certain level, if I can't understand what someone is actually talking to me about because I haven't had any experience with it or haven't used it, can't do it myself in any way at all, and it's important to what I'm doing, like the projects I'm working on that's sort of the tipping point for me. I say, oh, I need to spend time with this. Learn it to the extent that I can in the
you
time that
the
I have.
You can talk the talk, yeah.
Otherwise, I become, well, kind of outdated and useless on projects. And you see that happen at times where people are just like, oh, we needed this thing. This person was working with us, but they clearly didn't understand it, so their work is incomplete.
Yeah. So, but aren't we like getting a little fatigued with all these new tools? I feel like
maybe.
Yeah. I feel like there's like there's all these new tools that are coming in, and we're constantly raising the barrier of entry for anybody, even developers that spend all day building web apps. There's so much new stuff, and then it just gets thrown into these projects.
I think you get fatigued if you don't spend your time wisely. Yeah. Right? Like okay. We don't play around with everything new that comes out unless we actually see a legitimate use case with something we're doing. But again, maybe this is just how you structure your time as well, right? Like most people in our company will spend, you know, roughly 25% of their time only working on open source stuff. And the point of that isn't so that we have all of these libraries that we produce, even though we've certainly pulled that off as well, as much as that's your chance to go and mess around with what everybody's talking about and see if there's merit based on the things you're interested in. And if you approach it like that, we actually find a lot of the new stuff that comes out quite exciting. That's because there's no pressure to actually deliver something real with it. Maybe that's something that's going on as well.
Yeah. Okay. And I think it's important to think about your teams at that point too, because you know we see these swings happen, especially within the web industry, where you know, well, specialists, then it's about generalists. And I would say at this point, we need to have people that know their stuff, right? And that can work with other people that know their stuff. Otherwise, you know, a single generalist cannot keep up with everything that they may need to do. You know, it is important to use your time wisely, but it's also important to have the right people around you. Even if you're an individual, like a freelancer working on your own, you can still get good pairings. Because I recognize there are times where, like, I cannot code the thing that I'm imagining right now. And so I need a pairing. I need someone to work with me at that moment. So I think that is really helpful too, to help eliminate the fatigue, to let people be good at what they're good at and learn those things, and let others be good at what they're good at, without getting like too narrow a focus too.
So, yeah.
And I also think if anyone in this room is feeling kind of bummed out at all the speed of change and tooling, I think it's gonna get much easier. We're really in the first days of this whole JavaScript tooling. Like, If you remember HTML5 boilerplate back, like, how many years ago was that? Like, 4 years or so ago? Like, not that long. 4 or 5 years ago, that was built with an Ant script. We didn't have any sort of build system with JavaScript. So we're all just really figuring this out in terms of how it works. And I think it's going to get a lot easier for developers to use these build tools. And it already is. And things like Ember, it's much easier than it is for React or anything like that.
Yeah. Sometimes I've even seen, like, make files.
Yeah.
Believe that.
Yeah, make files, amp files, all those build files. That's what people used for like 20 years until we had, at least in web development.
So we're still in early days and all of these tools are evolving.
Yeah.
So what do we do when you've already built a project and you have this tool set already there?
Yeah.
And you maybe forget about it or your focus shifts elsewhere. But the people that are using that, are they forced to sort of stay behind and support all these old tools? What do we do there?
I don't know, if it gives you more value to change, then change. If not, then stick with it and keep working on your app.
So in my project, I might have like Grunt, Gulp, Webpack, and every other
You shouldn't have
flavor.
That, all three of them. You should have have one that does what you need.
Okay.
Yeah, SmackDown.
Yeah.
This is also why we bet, like I know it's different in every framework, but this is one of the reasons we chose to use Ember, especially for client work. Is the way, I don't know whether anybody's read into it. If not, I'd go and Google how the release cycle actually works. I forget the numbers off the top of my head, but I think it's every 6 weeks is the new release, and we're told what will be in the new release ahead of time.
Yeah.
We're given 2 release cycles to handle deprecations, and we're warned about them. There's always an upgrade path given in between ones that's incredibly simple.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of watch what's happened in the other two communities, and it's not a major knock, but because they're not trying to be complete frameworks of structure.
I think, yeah, I think you're aiming that at
Angular. I never hear Ember developers complain.
No, this is like, we certainly have our problems in our framework. But
yeah,
this is something that...
It's not one of them.
Yeah, and it's been addressed for this reason, because realistically, otherwise we'd have to tell clients that the stuff I write for you today will expire within a year, probably sooner. And you can pay me to keep maintaining and fixing that. But usually they say no. So we discovered if we didn't have to say that, they'd give us more money up front, which is typically what we're interested in.
Makes sense.
So you sort of built in this expiry date into all the projects that you build?
So if we didn't use Ember, I feel like we would have needed to.
Okay. But
we're very much given an upgrade path. Like, it's something that's being treated very seriously in that community.
But you still need to spend the time to actually do the upgrades.
Yes, but I'm trying to think the right way to frame it compared to, say, if you're in a React, your router may have changed, right? That's a new canonical router.
Yeah.
That's not a problem we have. We may need to go and do a syntactic change.
Yeah.
You know, a good example would be we went from something called action bubbling to something, you know, basically closure-driven actions where passing the function directly into the component, perhaps a little bit more similar to React because there is a lot of cross-inspiration happening here. But for us, that was a very simple change, right? We had to go and change bindings, which is one line, versus needing to go and replace a router or go and figure out how we're going to re-architect this based on the new mental model. And that's very much something that's been helpful in terms of keeping apps alive for much longer.
Longer time. And so the other question is, like, I sort of want to dive in a little bit here into the actual build tools, if you guys would allow me. We've seen Grunt slowly disappear, yet it was still, and I think it still is, like the most popular ecosystem out there, but like the Grunt project itself seems to be stagnating. Do you feel that that's the case, or are you still actively using Grunt, or have you moved on to something else?
I personally don't use it, but it's definitely not stagnant. It's been being worked on. Okay. You can check out the GitHub, but yeah, I don't know. It's not everyone's choice of tool this day, and if you want to use something else, then you're free to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. When Gulp came out, I switched. It felt a little bit more familiar to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, so I don't know.
Okay.
And in my world, we're abstracted from this, right? We've had a CLI for quite a while. Angular does now as well, actually.
Yeah.
So as much as, you know, the underlying mechanism may have changed, I sort of just run Ember build like I always have. And yes, a different engine fixes that for me.
Like, maybe we should explain that. So Ember uses Broccoli under the hood, is that right? Yeah, so, and like most people probably don't know that because they just run, they type in their command and it works, right? It's not something they have to worry about.
Okay. And the other question that I had is, and this is because I've seen it a lot more at conferences recently, NPM run and sort of having NPM be the place where you put all your scripts. Are you guys doing that? Is that something that developers should maybe start looking into?
Yeah, it's great. I don't know, I get this question like every day. So NPM scripts is really nice because you don't have to have any global things installed on your machine. You can, you'll surface all the bins from your node modules directory, which is really nice. It's really quick. It's really easy to get up and running. You don't have to like depend on a specific version of like if Gulp SaaS, it's using a specific version of SaaS. You can use whatever version of SaaS that you'd like. So that's great. It can get out of hand really quickly, and I know that's a bit of a people get angry when I say that, but it can get out of hand pretty quickly. I use it for smaller stuff, and then I'll use something like Gulp or Webpack for larger stuff. And then also, people use NPM scripts to run, to kick off their Webpack processes, and then they put some of the more complexities in their Webpack file.
So I love that you mentioned that, because that was actually my next question.
Yeah.
Webpack seems to be becoming more popular.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, why are you moving to Webpack versus Gulp? Like,
It's not really like a fair comparison either. So like Webpack is sort of a task runner, but it also is a JavaScript bundler in one. So that's sort of why people are moving towards it, where it just does everything for them. With Gulp, what you need is you need something to bundle your JavaScript, like Webpack or Browserify or Rollup or System.js, any of these, and then you also use Gulp. So it's really just like boils down to like what are you building. Generally, in these heavy JavaScript apps, people are going towards Webpack. But if you're just doing a HTML, CSS, then I think Gulp is a good use case for that as well. I wouldn't discount it entirely.
Do people in Angular use Webpack?
That's a good question. I don't know what they're doing right now for 2.0. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure.
From what I've seen, it they are using Webpack.
Okay. I was just
some
curious.
Apps, yeah.
Again, we just use a CLI and don't worry about this.
That's
problem.
That's a nice little world.
I like that.
Yeah.
So, not us.
Problems I don't have.
It's a good way to do it.
That's awesome. So speaking of Webpack, though, and the whole bundling aspect of things.
Yeah.
And this is going to impact the user experience. With how Webpack is evolving and sort of using Webpack not only to just bundle JavaScript, but also to bundle CSS files, the HTML files, maybe even run them through a minification. And there seems to be this like slight migration backwards in time, where now we're sort of putting more inline CSS, and we're putting in more like inline images even. How do you feel that like these tools are gonna affect the user experience, if at all?
The inline CSS thing is also another hot button issue. But I think what it is, it's really trying to do is...
We're pushing the buttons here.
Yeah, you guys try and push some buttons here. What it's trying to do is move towards more componentized design, and I'm sure you can talk on this, is that rather than developing an entire website, you develop pieces of your website, and then you have CSS that's attached to that specific, and you have JavaScript that's attached to that specific component in your website, and then it helps the growing pains of really large applications where things start to get really messy after a year or two of devving on it, where you just build these little pieces and click them together like Lego. Let's hear from, what do you have to say about that?
Well, yeah, the whole idea of like component design and like how you mentioned Brad, what he talks about with atomic design, which is really just system design, just giving it nice names, and that you could have this pattern library where these things are attached to those, makes it so much easier for larger organizations or things that are scaling for them to just say, oh, this is how this thing works, let's say responsively, mm-hmm. right? And we don't have to have it be dependent on
like the body tag.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like that. Oh, we have to have a different template every time we want this thing to work.
Yeah. Or like the way someone else's CSS is messing with mine, or something like that.
So it's definitely a different way of thinking than I think a lot of projects thought of things of 5 years ago. Yeah. Sort of at the cusp of people adopting responsive web design as an approach, but. It as you start to use it, the component design, it just makes sense. Yeah. It's sort of like the first time you use something like SAS or LESS or something that you've never done before, and then you go into it and go, this is painful a little bit, and then after a while, it starts to feel right.
Yeah.
Until you learn the next thing, and you go, oh, this one's better too.
Yeah. So components, though, so we've seen that on the UX side, and it's happening as well on the website. In the next year, do you feel that web components as a standard might come around and become popular, or will we stick with React components or Angular components? Or
do you think they're mutually exclusive?
Or are they mutually exclusive?
Yeah, I wouldn't think that they were. Actually, like it may be your approach to things, but let's say I work with the city of Surrey right now, working on a project where we're doing a pattern library, and some people on their team would care about that specific question. But others are just going to look at it and say, well, this is just how it works. This is what this thing is. Mm-hmm. And so they're just thinking of it in components rather than how it's built, whereas others are thinking about how it's built. But I think that they're tied together, right? That we can't separate that thinking out. Of course, that's me looking at it from perspective of someone that isn't, that is not going further than like the CSS and light JavaScript understanding.
Yeah. So. How do you feel?
About components?
Yeah.
I think they're great. I don't think that everybody's going to build every website in components. There's obviously still benefits to the cascading part of CSS.
Yeah.
And I don't think that we're just going to run out and have to be reapplying our font size on every specific thing. But in a lot of cases, especially when you have applications where you've got different pieces coming in all over the place, I think it's a great idea.
Well, and it fits in with the cascade, though, still. Like, a good pattern library or style guide will have those global elements that cascade down into those. But then we got these specific things that really do... It is hard to not say Pacific now.
Pacific.
I'm missing home, Vancouver.
It's your fault.
But it's hard to not have those needs now. Because a lot of web applications are very complex. A lot of websites are very complex. The government services in the UK... This article just came out, I think today, that they put a ban on developing apps No apps. They're not allowed to do it at all. It's all responsive web. So, which, you know, in some senses could be considered a web app. But that's because they feel that they can do what they need to do and that it uses their resources better. Because I can't remember the other country that they were referencing, that was their goal was to build 300 apps a year for their government. Okay. And they're like, how are you going to sustain that? Like, what humongous team is going to take care of all those things?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that one or the other is really right, but it's interesting to look at that and to think, yeah, we can do these things on the web that way now.
Mm-hmm. So maybe let's take a little bit of a more higher level view. Going back to the idea of tooling, now that we have, say, something like Bash on Windows, are we actually going to have tooling that will work everywhere the same? Is that going to happen, finally?
I hope so. I think Bash on Windows is really exciting because it just makes all the stuff that we're talking about, us as developers with $3,000 MacBook Pros, accessible to absolutely everyone. And I think Node has gone a long way in making these tools accessible already on Windows and other computers, but I think that's going to really push it forward where it's not an issue for anyone, regardless of hardware setup, to be able to participate in these things.
Mm-hmm. It's going to take time, and maybe I shouldn't say this here, but so we maintain the main Ember Cordova bindings. And occasionally you get somebody with just this issue that you can't explain what's going on, right? Something didn't build. And the first thought that used to go through my head is, oh, they must be on Windows, right? They don't have Bash, and I don't know how they're running this thing. And thus, you know, they're probably having some weird problems. But now that we can actually start accommodating the case without having to write this specific edge case programming, it's becoming a much simpler proposition.
Yeah.
It's just not something that will happen immediately, right? It's going to take time.
Okay. So speaking of these cross-platform tools, how about cross-platform app frameworks? So how are you guys building sort of your cross-platform apps? Is it just through the browser? Is that your sort of main platform? Or are you using Cordova? I know you mentioned Cordova, but
So on our front, and I'm curious to hear what you all do as well. So we obviously do develop, we tend to try and develop in Chrome and Safari. For those who don't know, Safari is way more performant. Mobile Safari will outperform desktop Chrome. If you want to run benchmarks, it's incredibly depressing. So we'll tend to just build a single Ember app. We'll wrap that for web with a build command. We'll wrap that for mobile with a very different build command for Ember Cordova. And we actually use this thing called Electron to build a desktop app as well.
Mm-hmm.
The only distinction you'd see in our app is we've actually come to the conclusion that we don't try and use responsive media queries to make the template fit all three. We believe that components will be the same across all platforms and will be fluid to their container. We'll actually write completely separate layouts for all of the platforms. And that saves us just needing to have all of these complex queries going on that might make sense immediately, but 6 months later, nobody has any idea what you are trying to do. And obviously, as well, when you're dealing with something like mobile, you don't want all this garbage that's not actually being rendered to be anywhere near the page. So it's nice just having completely separate templates. Might take you an extra hour into developing, but seriously, not much more than that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much my thoughts exactly. I don't build a ton of apps, but I've dabbled in React Native, and I think it's really exciting the sort of the way that they're going. You can share a lot of your logic and the JavaScript behind about what happens, but that actual view layer happens, and the templating and stuff happens from platform to platform.
And are we seeing sort of a shift in how developers are building these cross-platform apps now that we do have things like React Native versus Cordova? Are they shifting away from the whole idea of an app manifest that sort of just basically wraps the web app to something like React Native?
I don't know if I can answer for all of mobile developers everywhere, especially because don't do well. Please answer for everybody. But I definitely see a lot of people shifting over from something like Cordova into React Native. Or I was just talking to him about the stuff that's happening in Ember, so that sounds pretty promising, just because we've had a couple years of just trying to do web on, and then people are kind of like, yeah, it works, kind of, right? They always have those four or five apps that they tout as being you can't tell if it's native or not, and but there's never a ton that I've seen.
If I can push back on just that last statement, though,
yeah.
So often when you're looking at somebody who's got a hybrid app that's not doing what it should, Like, yes, there are a lot of cases where just what they were trying to do was never possible, but so many others, they just wrapped a web app in mobile, maybe changed their clicks to touch, and were like, hey, I've got a mobile app. I hope this thing works.
And they don't understand. That's exactly what I'm talking about, is that it's people do that, right?
Yeah, it's a lot more work to make the thing actually feel like it's responsive as mobile. And if you know what you're doing, it's not like it's going to take you another 4 weeks or 5 weeks, but it's a process of understanding how this thing actually executes on a phone and what's different because of that. Like, my favorite one is just people who are like firing an AJAX request while an animation's going. You're like, of course this isn't going to work, right? You're going to block one thing or the other. Maybe sequence your events a little bit better. Mm-hmm.
And now, I'd like to sort of debate you on that whole point that you can't build really powerful apps with web browsers, like with web views wrapped around. Just to sort of raise the Electron example, we're seeing apps like Visual Studio Code that's built entirely in Electron, and you literally cannot tell the difference if it's native or actually web technologies behind it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm totally on board with that as well. It depends on, I guess, the device as well, right? Okay. Like Visual Studio Code runs sweet on my expensive MacBook Pro.
Yeah. But obviously you wouldn't run that on an iPhone or something.
Yeah, I'd like to see it run on an iPhone and see how it holds up.
Mobile is the one that bites the most people. And I honestly think half the problem is they just throw juniors at it thinking, hey, I'm just going to get the web person to go and figure out how to make it work on mobile. Okay. Which again is obviously not going to work. That's just very wishful thinking.
Because you really have to know what you're doing, right?
Okay.
But it's still a little bit of that wishful thinking that people are still clinging on to. Like that developer dream that you're writing once and deploying everywhere and never going to have to tweak for different platforms or accommodate or even adapt the UI or UX of a specific platform. And like what I just heard from you both was, you know, the reality is you write all the stuff, but you are going to be tweaking here and you are going to be doing that, whether it's, and that's true for if you're doing native apps across the board too, whether it's native or mobile, right?
I think that's the most important point is you can share a lot of the stuff you're doing, but you do need to go case by case and really just tune it up so it works on those platforms.
Realistically, we believe that you will, like I said earlier, rewrite your templates for the platform. What we actually want to preserve is our routing, how our actions are going to be handled, what our models look like, how our models are going to communicate with the server. This is the stuff we actually want to preserve, which if you're doing well, might be 80-85% of your code base, and it's that last mile that you just keep retargeting based on what you want to ship it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do you approach the UX when you're looking at designing these things?
Well, I think it's sort of what was shared too, just the idea that I remember people saying when responsive design started to become a thing that hey, it's just one website, you know, and it's all the same content and everything, which is, you know, mostly true, let's say, and there's concepts behind that's a little bit easier to maintain, but the idea of this other final 10-15% was like, no, you know what, we actually need some adaptive content here. And there are some different needs, and there are things that need to be designed differently here, and we have to think about those. And so, you know, for me, in my process, and what we work through when we're looking at these clunky content problems to do with responsive or mobile or adaptive content, it's a lot of content modeling. We get in there and say, okay, well, what are the actual needs? How do these things work together? How will they work, you know, on this platform versus that? You know, and then representing good business goals within that and priorities too. Mm-hmm. Of course, overarching for me is to talk to people. What do the people need that are going to be using the things that we're building too? And then to bring that into that content model. But when we're doing content modeling on a project, we're doing it with a developer in the room with us, though. Mm-hmm. It's not in isolation where we come back and say, hey, here's this content model. It's totally going to break, because it will. It's going to break anyways at some point. But again, that interdisciplinary moment is key.
Okay. So we have new tools that popped up. And this one is a bit of a sort of hot button issue, I guess. And I like to bring them up because I like to press the button all the time. So here's the thing, like we've got React Native. It's a whole different way of building these cross-platform apps, but it's really powerful now. I mean, you even have support for UWP in React Native. So you have Windows, iOS, Android, pretty much anyone who's building React Native can run their native app now everywhere. But isn't that a bit of a departure from the whole ideals of the web and web standards? On the other hand, we have this thing called Manifold.js that uses the W3C Web App Manifest standard to actually package up your web app as a mobile app, right? So what are we doing here? Should we support this a standard that's already out there, where in theory, if you are building a responsive web design quite well, and you are completing that last 15% quite well using purely web technologies, shouldn't you be able to wrap that up and just put that on a mobile app versus using something like React Native?
I think that's the wishful thinking that too many people engage in, and then it kind of bites them. Like, the reality is there are just a lot of little differences. Like, the most obvious example, but I'm going to say it, is that a click has a 200 millisecond delay, and if you don't start rewriting to fire on touch events, then you immediately have a problem, and that one's incredibly obvious, but that's a sign that you actually do need to do a little bit of extra work per platform. And then in my world, most browser vendors don't implement the standards anyway, so how we're expected to like adhere to those and uphold those, I'm not actually aware. And coming to the React Native point, this is something we debate back and forth, because we obviously maintain Ember Cordova. So it's like, okay, should we go down in this and start worrying about an Ember Native as well?
Yeah.
And that's actually still TBD in our world, right? We're still trying to decide whether this will actually help us or hurt us, and I don't know the answer to that one yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I also don't know the answer to that. All I know is that companies have tried it, and then there's people like Facebook who obviously know a thing or two about building apps. They say, hey, we tried it, and it's we would love to be able to share our code base, and they do share a lot of their code base in between them, but it's not working for them. So maybe one day we'll be able to just
Facebook
do it.
Facebook created React Native, though.
Yeah, that's exactly why they created it, because like you write 80% once, and then that last mile you need to really fine-tune platform by platform, which really isn't a huge deal at the end of the day.
Okay. All right. Any last comments on the future? What are you excited about the most?
Why does everyone look to me when you say excited?
You're very passionate.
What am I excited about? I don't know. Damn you guys. I mean, again, I'm just going to go back to the fun stuff, right?
Okay.
Like, never mind the clients and the production, but I think the fun stuff is, I'm just excited about people exploring JavaScript outside of the browser specifically.
Okay.
You know, beyond the I'm excited about beyond the browser.
Mm-hmm.
How's that?
Yeah, I think JavaScript is, like, once you get past that build tool and the hard part about learning JavaScript, I think it's really exciting because I teach a lot of people, and all of a sudden you see these people being like, I can build anything. I can actually start to build the things that I've been dreaming about. I'm really excited to see all of these new frameworks and stuff that make making your apps a reality.
Yeah, so I'm excited about two things. One of them is everybody here rewriting their whole app in Ember after this talk. The second one explicitly, though, is maybe this is just us as a company, but I feel like it's broader even outside of Ember, is that our discussions have changed in the last, you know, 6 months, year, from what is the best way to structure the thing we're trying to build in terms of, you know, components, models, routes, controllers, what do we want, to, okay, we have a pattern that's working, how do we make this thing just go really fast now? And that's actually a very nice spot to be in.
I'd say for me, it's something I'm excited about and hopeful for, is accessibility on the web.
Okay.
You know, and how that has like dramatically changed over the last decade, for sure. But the possibilities, a friend of mine, well, Aaron Gustafson, also part of Microsoft family, he just like threw out this comment once, and he just said that if you're not building your site to be accessible, you're discriminating against people. You know, and the idea that someone would build a site that a 5'7" man couldn't use, so me, like just seems absurd. But there are times where we build sites and or apps, and someone that is non-sighted can't use it because of the way that it's been built. And I'm not saying it's any of you in this room, but it happens across the web. And you know, some of the things that are happening within JavaScript, just the web in general, are really hopeful. That way of saying that no, we can make this thing so the web doesn't discriminate against people. That's something I'm excited about. That's not specific to the future of the web, but right now it's a big focus on the work that I'm doing. So,
but I actually feel it is a big focus in what's happening in the web right now.
Yeah.
Even us with the Edge browser, we actually have an accessibility view now, which doesn't exist for so long, where you can see like what an accessible reader, a screen reader, might see, for example. when they get that HTML page. So I think the future is very bright, and it's very exciting. There's still a lot of unresolved questions. We're not quite sure which direction everybody will end up adopting in the end, but it is quite awesome. Don't you agree? Yeah. Okay.
Thought
I'd write JavaScript. Future. Stoked. Awesome. So we've got 5 minutes left, or actually a little bit less than that. Are there any questions for our panelists?
Really just curious, because I teach students web design and development.
Yeah.
And we move on from simple box model document flow over to Flexbox. Then we eventually get to SAS. And they ask me, why did we learn all these things?
Yeah.
So I'm curious what you guys think. Once we abstract with all these libraries and all these packages, will we still need that deep understanding? Do you think we'll get to a point where we've just abstracted from there so much that it's not even worth understanding those or teaching those?
Maybe a good way to answer that with analogy is people were complaining when Lisp was a thing that people wouldn't know how to write C, and you see the same complaints that people couldn't learn how to program with Ruby. And the answer is that as much as I would like to admit it's false, the average developer probably doesn't need to know those things until you're actually diving into fixed performance or work on tooling. And if it makes it easier for a bunch more people to actually start getting involved, that's not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. That being said, for your own career and hopefully personal interest, you probably should learn these things.
Yeah, and also, so I teach a lot as well, and teach box model and all that stuff, and you have to know that stuff, because what we find happens is that if someone comes in guns blazing with Bootstrap and Foundation right here, the questions start to go, why is Bootstrap collapsing this div, or this is all messed up, why is Bootstrap doing that? And it's like, no, you have to actually understand how to put a background on a div, or how to clear a float, or how Flexbox actually works, because when you need to do something that's anything custom other than your three columns with icons on top of it, you're going to be out of luck. So it's frustrating for newbies to be like, okay, let's learn how to change a font color and things like that before you can, like, everyone wants to do parallax scrolling first day, but you do need to know that stuff. You don't have to teach it all up front. What we do is we teach some, and then you build some stuff with a framework, and then you go back and forth, because that's how I learn, right? You go back and forth, and as you need these different pieces of fundamentals, you pick them up.
But I do think for the average web dev, like a student who knew nothing right now, and they had to pick it up right now, I do think it's scary. Like, and we're saying learn vanilla JavaScript, but where does that exist? Like, everything that you look is a jQuery example or a tutorial or any of that kind of stuff. So I do think for average students, it's definitely essential, I agree. I also, it's confusing, and it's a hard landscape because they want to be up and running, and all these tools solve those problems and make you more efficient, and that's where they want to be, right? And that's where I want to be too, you know?
That's exactly why when we teach JavaScript, we teach couple weeks of fundamentals, and then we get into jQuery because it just lets you do stuff that you want to do immediately. And then as we're teaching it, you make sure that they understand that this is event binding and this is delegation and all these different pieces that are core to actual JavaScript. But you do need to have these successes in development. Otherwise, it's just boring learning about, like, whatever the fundamentals, right?
So you, like, open the hood. And you said, yeah. What's inside?
You show a couple.
And then we shut it. And then we just play with the car, and then we open it
back
again.
Back and forth between the two, and then by the time you're done, you're up to speed with both of them.
Right.
All right, so I think that's it for our panel. Thank you so much.
There's
one more question. Okay.
It's going to be a good one.
Okay, you're
so this is, I'm not a web developer, so this is more of a big picture question, talking about the future of the web. I was going to ask about your thoughts on WebGL and developing the web for AR and VR. And you know, those new platforms for
that's for game
the web.
Designers and that's
I think the when you're looking at things like A-Frame and you know, allowing you to build a very quick kind of web VR, you know, I don't know if I've seen too much in production. I did a tour of agencies across the U.S. Asking them, and a lot of them were using something like A-Frame the framework for production. And prototyping, but not necessarily putting it out, like just kind of like putting it in front of a client. So I think there's a little bit of progression to go there, but I think it's interesting that a web dev could now create more of a kind of experiential experience. using those technologies, and I think that's only going to progress. If you look at you know, the status of VR and AR and mixed reality, whatever you want to call it, I mean, that's just going to grow. And if the browser is a place that it belongs is debatable, and I don't want to go down that route, but I think you're going to see more development on it, and you can just see the support from the different 3D libraries and it moving away from game development into you know, medical purposes and things like that. I think right now for prototyping, it's really fast and dirty and easy to get going. Outside of that, though, I haven't seen a lot in production. That doesn't answer your question, yeah, but some thoughts.
I'll just interject really quickly because I know we're short on time here, but you know, 10 years ago, touch interfaces, the way that we use them, were totally different. Like, it just was a concept we were working with regularly, and now it's a concept we can't work without. And I think how we define the web is going to change over time, and what that is, where that information is coming from. So I'm personally excited about things like that, and how, you know, an interface without a UI works, right? And things like that, audible interfaces, you know, VR interfaces. So I think there's a lot of possibility there. We just are still super experimental with it.
Yeah, last comment is, like, we've had people ask us about, you know, using WebGL, but it would maybe improve render performance. And the answer ended up being that, you know, at EmberConf this year, Glimmer 2 can now benchmark at 60 frames per second. Obviously, in a production environment, that's going to drop. But all of a sudden, we don't need to worry about using WebGL for that purpose anymore. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that happening as well, or in generation one with a lot of the things you referenced, and like anything, that's just going to fall by the wayside in 6 months, 12 months for better tools.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Our panelists will be around, so if you do have more questions, you'll be able to ask them. And that will basically conclude our Build Toronto tour. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us today.